As a way of introduction, I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking through a few things, and then I'll introduce my panelists to the left of me here. Now, as your moderator this panel and the others this weekend, I will offer you a kind of brief background to these topics. My name is Stuart Hutton. I'm Chief Investment Officer for a company called Simply Ethical, and I'm also a member and founding emissary of an organization called the Responsible Finance and Investment Foundation. Now, we've been pursuing a number of initiatives as to how money, finance, and banking can and should change for the better, for the common good, and for those who really need it. There are already calls to actions. His Holiness the Pope Francis, through his encyclical, Laudato Si, has clearly stated we must leave no one behind. At the same time, he said that after a broad consultation with almost 200 governments worldwide and about 5 million people, 17 goals were set out by the UN to achieve by 2030. We only have about 11 years to go. Unfortunately, we still live in a selfish economic model with growing inequalities and actions by countries' leaders that often lead to destruction of any chance for solidarity. There is no doubt that the finance sector, even since the credit crisis of 10 years ago, is still contributing significantly to accelerating environmental degradation, increasing inequalities, and a weakening of social protection standards. We got a cheer. Wow, I've obviously said something right tonight. To change this, we need to turn the finance works completely around. And for those working in finance, we need to be instrumental in achieving this quickly. There needs to be support for a transition to a sustainable economy that acts as stewards to the impact it has on society. We need to look at how we support decarbonizing our economies, stabilizing the financial systems, and make it serve society. However, if we just rely on the financial sector alone to lead this, how can we trust that it will? It is now a more common view that it's the investor, savers and depositors like us here today that will push the direction of travel and accelerate its shift as needed to make a sustainable investing the way forward. So what about our faith? Where does this all fit in, and how is this going to we're going to discuss this basically today and how we need to look at this across the panel and my guest today, who I'll introduce shortly. And hopefully also a chance for yourself, and I will look to see if there are any questions once we get into it. Now, I have three panelists here I'd like to introduce. To my left first, I have Safina Lalani. Safina Lalani is the head of institutional funding at the British Red Cross. She's leading strategies and working closely with institutional and trust specialists and has worked in several key roles of partnership development with Oxfam, the VSO, and is a trustee for the Action for Children in Conflict. Next to Safina, I have Shakib Saklan, who's IslamicMarkets.com. Shakib is the founder and CEO of IslamicMarkets.com, the world's largest financial intelligence and investing platform for the Islamic economy. Having worked over the last decade for industry giants like Bloomberg, Morgan Stanley, and Dubai Islamic Bank, he has a master's in economics development and policy analysis from University of Nottingham. And then finally, on the far left, I'd like to introduce Masoom Mahmood. Masoom is a good friend of mine and an ethical finance expert, especially focusing around education. He specializes in governance, agricultural financial management, and social financial inclusion. He's recently been appointed as a business development specialist for the global Islamic advisory firm Gateway, and is also recently appointed as a trustee of the Ansar Trust, which he'll explain a little more about. So I'm going to hand over shortly to Safina to talk a little bit about her background and the work they're doing and explain how maybe faith has a role in that. But I have a little quote to start off with. Anybody who maybe, no one's probably seen me speak before, I love quotes. This was from L. Ron Hubbard. Who knows who L. Ron Hubbard is here? You may have heard this one. He says, if you want to make a little money, write a book. If you want to make a lot of money, create a religion. So with that, I'm going to turn to Safina. And Safina, if you could perhaps give us a little bit of an introduction and talk yourself.
Thank you. So first of all, I just wanted to thank Stuart for inviting me to this event. And it's my first time at Greenbelt. What a fantastic event. Thank you so much. And what an interesting panel and such a timely topic. So Stuart's given some background to my role at the British Red Cross. So the British Red Cross, I'm not sure how many of you are aware, is part of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, and we work across the globe in over 190 countries, but also work here in the United Kingdom. And within the UK, so last year we supported over 30,000 people through our refugee support and integration work and helped reunite over 4,000 families. I'm sure many of you remember the tragic events of last year, the Manchester bombings, the London attacks, and Grenfell. So it was our volunteers who were on the front line providing emotional and practical support following those events. So as Stuart has given some background, I've been working in the development and humanitarian space now for about 10 years. And in this time, the global humanitarian challenges are just increasing. Disasters are striking more frequently, and they're now much more intense than they were many years ago. If you just think about what's happening today, if you think about Syria, Yemen, what's happening in Cox's Bazar in terms of the crisis with refugees, you've got 1 million refugees who are stranded there. And of course, you have the slow onset in parts of Africa, so East Africa. So there's millions of people affected around the world, and the numbers of displaced people are continuing to rise. So at the moment, there's 60 million displaced people all around the world from having to flee their countries because of natural and man-made disasters or conflict. And it's staggering, and this figure is more than any time since the Second World War. So there are huge challenges facing our humanitarian ecosystem, and it's a huge effort, both practically but also financially. And many of us know, and in fact, Stuart touched upon the Sustainable Development Goals, that in order to really meet the Sustainable Development Goals, there's going to be a large financial gap. And we're already predicting that that's going to be in the range of $2.5 trillion. So what is the development and humanitarian community doing? Well, the traditional sources of funding from government, from our individual donors, so high net worth individuals, but mainly governments, funding is declining, and we're now starting to look at new ways and innovative ways that we can start to raise finance to support the global challenges that we're faced with. And that brings us on to faith. So you might be wondering how that all connects. I guess whatever faith we belong to, the act of giving and the act of almsgiving, the mandatory giving that some faiths have in place, is something that is actually inherent in each of our cultures. And Islam is the faith that I belong to. And within that faith, there is mandatory giving. So some of you may be familiar with the term zakat. And at the British Red Cross, and in fact, the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, we're starting to explore how we can work a little bit closely and really engage with the Islamic community to support us meet the humanitarian challenges that we're faced with. So there's around $300 billion that it's channeled through zakat currently. And the impact of this is not very well recorded at present. So along with Islam, well, we're calling this Islamic social finance, and there's many terms that are used. But in addition to Islamic social finance, we're also exploring social investment, impact investment. I guess if some of you in this room are working a similar line to Stuart, you're probably a little bit familiar with those terms. And we're looking at how we can tap into these forms of financing and really harness those to meet the demands facing the humanitarian community today. Now, let me just go back to zakat and Islamic giving. We're looking to really utilize the zakat to help us finance the challenges that we're faced with. And at the British Red Cross, and as part of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, we feel that there are lots of synergies with Islamic giving and the work that we're trying to do. In many of our countries that we're supporting around the world, we're looking at designing solutions that are very much grounded in what communities are wanting, so very much bottom up, but also that they are sustainable and transformative, so that when we exit the country, communities are able to continue and manage for themselves. And that really, there are some synergies there with the kind of principles of Islam. So in terms of the giving being very much mission focused, being impactful, but also supporting not just, as a British Red Cross, we support all communities. So we're looking at that supporting not just Muslims, of course, but anyone. So very much inclusive participation. And there's a really exciting piece of work that's taking place at the moment, which has already had some very transformative and remarkable results. And it's a little story from Kenya that I'm just going to share with you today. So last year, as I'm sure some of you are aware, one of the worst droughts reached crisis point in Kenya, and 2.7 million people needed assistance. 80% of Kenya is semi-arid or arid, and there were a recurrent pattern of droughts. So in 2016, we had below average rainfall, which in fact worsened the drought. And at the peak of the drought, 2.7 million people needed assistance. So, you know, when there's drought, I probably don't need to tell you this, you know, crops are affected, basic things such as maize damaged, livestock prices decline, animals are unwell, so then people don't eat as much and people become malnourished. And that's when the Red Cross decided they needed to do something different. We already had our appeal. We had launched an appeal, but we weren't raising the funds that we needed to support this community. And we had a very active member in our Red Crescent movement who was already looking at how we could tap into Islamic giving. So we were able to channel Islamic funds from estates in Malaysia all the way to Kenya. So that's, I guess, our first pilot in southern Kenya, Kitui, which was the worst affected area of the drought. $1.2 million was pledged from a particular district in Malaysia where Islamic giving is mandatory. So we were able to tap into that to support over 175,000 families in Kenya. Now, what's really interesting and remarkable about this is that it was sustainable. So the families that were supported, through the money, they were able to purchase seeds. But after a certain point, they were able to then, it was sufficient enough that they actually made $1 million themselves by selling on their crops. So the pay it forward concept is then they were able to support another community. So it was, in fact, very transformative, very sustainable. And that's just the first pilot. And that is hot off the press, actually. So a huge return on that investment. And that's what we're looking to do more of, to really be able to support the needs of the global humanitarian community. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. For those of you who are familiar, the Zakat in terms of one of the five pillars of Islam is a very important focus on an annual basis, normally given around Ramadan when it's a more focused position. And this was as a pilot. I know the lady who was kind of instrumental in launching this. And what was interesting is that when they looked into how much Zakat is actually around the world, and this is just a small grain of sand in the Sahara type scenario. And the reference point was given to me was that in Kuwait, where discussions are going on how they can take some of the zakat that's being gathered there, there's so much money, so many dollars, billions of dollars, that the machine they've been using it to kind of store how much on hasn't got enough zeros to actually show how much now. So they've just given up counting it. So when we sit and look at the SDGs, we look at the things that are going around the world, you start to realize how important that the money's there and we can make the difference. So thank you very much, Safina. I'd like to pass on to my next panelist, Shakib Sokol, who can perhaps interest, who has a maybe a little different focus and kind of story to tell. Shakib.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be here, and I'm looking forward especially to the discussions and some of the questions I'm sure you'll have. It's probably worth for me to start with just a little bit of a background on the environment, because I think that's very important in terms of when we talk about the breakdown of the financial system, when we talk about the credit crisis, and even if you want to talk about Brexit and things that are happening right now, it's important to look at the environment that led to this. And for me personally, in the early 2000s, just getting close to finishing university, like everybody here, we're thinking about how do we want to, you know, what career do we want to enter, what role do we want to get. And the things that we were seeing in the newspapers, in the headlines, the banker bonuses, the flashy cars, as students, these things really appealed to us at that time, especially as students when you had a mountain of debt. And we were one of the first generations of students that were leaving universities at that time with a large amount of debt. So for us, we couldn't really focus on the long-term sustainable development. For us, it was more about short-term needs and how we can pay off that debt. And for me, it was a case of how can I get into the hottest industry at the time, the banking industry. I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity at the time, and but the timing couldn't have been worse. This was when I entered Morgan Stanley, it was around 2008. And this was at a time when Lehman's was struggling, the whole industry was struggling. And I remember at the time when I was in my role, it was around 18 months or so into my role when Lehman's announced their bankruptcy. And the markets were just collapsing around us. And I took a step back and I thought to myself, you know, a few years ago, I made this pretty much a selfish decision in terms of entering this industry. And now I'm seeing that finance, when it's done like this, how destructive it can be. And it's not all just about big bonuses and flashy cars and so on. And that's when I, and not myself only, but a lot of my colleagues, we started doing a lot of soul searching. We started asking ourselves, you know, if we leave ourselves, the bankers and finance markets, unregulated, and if we don't have that level of control, what is the impact of this on real people, ordinary people? And for us, we started asking a lot of questions internally. And I remember at the same time, Morgan Stanley had a small Islamic finance team. And I thought to myself, what is this thing, Islamic finance? Let me just, you know, look into it. Let me research about this. And it piqued my interest. And I remember flying over. They were based in Dubai, and having a chat with the head of Islamic finance there. And I said, okay, you know, I want to learn more about this. How does this stop us and prevent what happened before? And for me, he taught me two things, which I was like, this actually could be quite transformative if we were to implement them. And one of the things that he said was that when it comes to developing more sustainable economies, more sustainable forms of development, we have to do not only redistribute wealth, and Islamic finance has things like zakat and you know, waqf, which is charitable endowments, we have to do them, but we also have to have more focus on risk sharing. And that struck a chord. Why did that, you know, resonate with me at the time was because I spent my whole career in banking finding more and more creative ways of transferring risk, moving risk from me as a banker onto other institutions. And in a lot of cases, ordinary people moving the risk onto them, or SMEs, you know, small organizations, and, you know, making myself as comfortable and as protected as I could from a risk point of view. So here was this guy and working in a too strong team, advising people that, you know, we have to move towards more risk sharing and finding more partnership way of doing banking. So this was something that I started, you know, getting a lot of interest in. And at that time, I left the industry and then moved into a local Islamic bank in Dubai. And I started learning more about how this industry was and you know, some of the opportunities and challenges that it faced. One of the things that I realized was that Islamic finance, if it was implemented in the way that we want it to be implemented, we could have dealt with some of the, you know, consequences of the credit crisis. But it was only when I left Islamic banking that I realized that some of the social instruments that the industry has, things like zakat, I would love to know from the audience here that how many of you know what the contribution of zakat is globally. The conservative estimates put zakat at $500 billion a year, which for me, and I only found this out when I left the industry, but for me this is incredible that it could actually get rid of poverty, not just in Muslim countries, but even in non-Muslim countries. So it is transformative, and for us, it's more about now bringing together the key institutions, key individuals, and it's reaching across different levels and actually finding ways we can actually collaborate and partner with people to realize the full potential of these products and these markets. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith. And it's a... Oh, there we are. And there's a really good point here, and there was a measure, I think. So you have zakat, which is the giving you give compulsory. You also have sadaqah, which is voluntary giving. And in the UK alone, you put in this figure, UK alone, each year, £300 million is raised through voluntary giving through the Islamic community. Now, when you consider that Islamic community is only 4 or 5% of the population, that is a phenomenal amount of money. So the link between faith and that kind of values is there's a lot of work going around. How can that be taken? How can that be pushed out? And on the basis that we're looking to achieve the SDGs, the figure that the UN kind of look at is around about $250 billion each year. Well, I think probably you can see quickly how actually we're there. We could do it, but we have to find instruments, a way of doing it. And we have to understand also how our faith, how our beliefs and our values actually connect through to our money. Because we live in a society where generally money doesn't connect that way. We have our bank account and our money on one side, and then we go to church. You know, we might give, we might even tithe. We might, you know, do something on a regular basis, but we don't link how these two impact on each other. And that's an important topic, which I believe, Brother Masoom, you're going to pick up with now. So please introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what we were talking about earlier. I think.
Okay, sorry, what's the topic again?
So I had to explain, he's a bit of a joker. So he's
no, honestly, like, finance is really boring, and I need to wake everybody up, okay? So, yeah, so I'm going to go, ole, 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 then you go, I. So, ole, ole, ole. Okay, thank you. Everybody's at Green Belt. Good afternoon. Yeah, thank you very much. So, my main reason why I transferred from a conventional to Islamic finance, my background is accounting and finance. Recently, I just studied Islamic finance. And what I found interesting was the tool that brings all religion together. So this is green card, okay, for you guys, green, and this is red card. So green card, if you understand the word interest, please. Oh, everybody's on green. Oh, brilliant. Okay. Interest is a word called riba in Islam. Okay, and it's prohibited, it's forbidden. And in Christianity, if you look at the book of Psalm, yeah, the book of Exodus as well. In Judaism, Leviticus, and the other one I forgot about it. And we can keep on going, I can keep on singing like Johnny Cash till tomorrow on this, regarding other religions as how they prohibit interest. Albert Einstein also added, there are two people that do understand interest. Yeah, if you do understand it, then you earn it. If you don't, you pay it. So I do pray you understand interest so that you earn it. Yeah, there are several verses that quotes about transparency, accountability in the Quran, Bible, and whatever. I mean, accountability itself is not limited to just, your spiritual and daily activities. It has social, contractual dealings, whatever you do daily. So Islamic finance is one of the key aspects in life that can engage you with those kind of things. So for instance, if you give me cash, I should give you a product or services without interest, without taking advantage. What is going on, and what I've realized, Islamic finance, and with people like Stuart, I mean, he's from a Christian background, but he's really active and engaged in the Islamic finance world because of the transparency in it. I know there is a lot of cosmetics. People are not using it in the right way, in the right direction. But if you put in an effort, like the effort we put in, for example, the trustee I became in recently, we offer interest-free loans. So what we do is we look at people that are struggling financially with debts only, if you promise us that you would not go back into that transaction. So you come in with £10,000 debt, then we'll clear off your debt if you're not going to use it to build up your credit ratings or clear off your step change, that sort of thing, to build up your reputation, then we'll clear it off for you, then you go interest-free. Muslim Christians, we support everyone because, I mean, the Prophet, peace be upon him, he got shelter from an Ethiopian king that was a Christian. So for us, Islam or Christianity, I mean, we are in the Western world and we practice Islam more ethical than those in Africa or South America or Asia because it's more of a transparent world here. Yeah, I'm glad to be a British-born national, even though without the British accent, I'm glad. But the thing is, you tend to practice things much, much better when you're in England or Europe or in North America. The other thing is we try to put more effort, like student finance is a big burden for our youngsters these days. So what we did as a community, we came in as one and we thought, okay, let's try and change the mindset of people, you know? Let's create, like, what the government did is called a takaful, a mutual funding. A takaful is sort of like an insurance where everybody in this room put in 10 pounds or whatever you can put in. But if you want to go into university, then you are qualified to join into that takaful. So we did come up with a Sharia finance ethical credit union based in Manchester called Yobi. We are going to kick off in October. We've been fully trained by Barclays Bank because they have a Sharia window as well. They're really supportive. And we're looking to start lending around February. We're going to be sustained by donors alone. So from Ansar Finance, we have more than 500 donors. For the past 20 years, we've lended over £3 million. This year alone, we gave out £270,000. I wish I was one of those beneficiaries, but I cannot as a trustee. Also, the other thing is, we're not just looking into student finance. We're looking into entrepreneurship, how to support the community. So if we can change the mindset of the whole community to create those kind of credit unions, it's similar to the cooperatives, the housing. If we can change the mindset of people to start going into that direction, I'm telling you, like, there will be a financial revolution because a lot of us are just capped with interest, debt. You want to pay your credit card bills. You get up for work, sometimes not even for your kids, just to clear up your debt, you know? It's used as an instrument, as Stuart mentioned earlier on, is sometimes unfree, unjust. At the same time, we can use that and turn it into a positivity, you know? So instead of us jumping into interest, let's try and avoid it and try and work out and put in the effort so that we can be interest-free at the long term and then at the long run. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Masoom. That was brilliant. When Masoom first arrived, he was in awe of Greenbelt Festival. I think he was, wow, this is, he had no idea what was going on here in some ways, having just travelled across from Manchester this morning. And I think he's probably going to be a regular visitor here, I think, given what he's seen so far. So welcome. I kind of wanted to pick up on that theme and try and thread these together in a bit more of a conversation. And also, we'll like to go to the floor for questions. So if you've got a question, start to kind of put it together and we'll make sure we've got the mic to get out to you so you can ask that question. But before we go into that, I just wanted to kind of understand, threading this together, how much, I'm going to ask it, and this is a free-for-all, one at a time, please. How much should our faith actually take a hold of how we manage our money? What value does that bring to it? Because, you know, we've sat here, we've talked through this already, kind of in terms of charitable giving, in terms of our journey and our banking, how it works, and even from a religious perspective, how important these things are. But actually, we still, you know, we will walk out of this tent and we revert back to norm, which is we have our banking, we have our religion, we have our faith, we have our finance. And it's about how we connect these. From my personal perspective, the reason I came into Islamic banking and Islamic finance 10 years ago, about the same time as you did, Shakib, I think it was, you know, was that I recognized that the banking sector was broken. It still is broken. It's not working. Fractional reserve banking is not the way we can actually make sure no one's left behind. It is there for the purpose of the shareholder. And we need to move towards a stewardship role, something that's more caring in the way it works. So for me, when I did my research, Islamic finance kept coming up and the journey is history. And I became kind of I won't say an expert in it, but certainly practicing it in terms of the work I do. And I think for me, I see it as a value-based initiative. I work in a world where my fellow directors are Muslims. I spend a lot of time in the Middle East and in Malaysia, and the work we do with so many different organizations from small to large. And the thing I recognize is that I go in there. I have a slight USP, actually, because I always wonder, how do you get recognized? I can walk into somewhere in Dubai, and I know I'm the only 6-foot-plus Christian called Stuart. So that is my USP. I was born with it, and I thank my parents for that. But putting that aside, I recognize that we had to do something about this. And there was something here that was stuck in a rut in its own. And the size of the Islamic finance market is around about $2.1 trillion, which sounds huge, but you know what, it's not. It's a couple of percent of the whole global market. It is nothing. It's growing as fast as anything else, so over 10% a year, 10 to 50% a year, and is expected to continue to grow. But when you're that small, that level of growth isn't that much. It needs to grow a lot faster. So I'm gonna revert back to you guys. So talk to me. Where do you think our faith should take a stronger lead? Where does our passion drive that? So we can try and connect these two across.
Just on that last point, you're absolutely right. The industry is growing, but it's tiny compared to where we are. And this, again, I think demonstrates why it's so important to build these alliances, get different stakeholders and institutions and individuals involved. In terms of why faith is important to finance, I guess the question is, what kind of a society do we want to live in? And if it's a society that's one of more inclusive and more equal form of development and growth, or is it a society where we continue to have increasing levels of inequality that we're getting at the moment? We have massive rise in food banks and other support across the country, the use of these food banks. So if we want a more fairer society, then we need to have some sort of guidance in terms of what is a structure. And for me, we gave the free rein to the bankers. We gave them an opportunity and we gave the free reins to the markets. And we realized that leaving people to their own free reins is a path which would lead to more and more inequality. So we need a form of guidance. Where Islamic finance is quite unique, and the reason why it's taken a stronghold in a lot of Muslim-majority countries, even in non-Muslim countries like the UK, I mean, London is positioning itself to be the one of the capitals of the Islamic finance market. The UK government issued an Islamic bond, a sukuk, for $250 million, I believe it was. The UK government is very keen to attract investment from these markets. In fact, we've been having discussions with them in terms of setting up a fund for companies, for SME companies, which attracts Islamic finance investing to support small and medium companies in the country. So it is about how we want to develop a more inclusive society. And the reason why Islamic finance is unique is because it has a reference point. And that's what makes it accountable. When you don't have that reference point, and when I say reference point, I'm talking about the scriptures, I'm talking about the revelation. And it's not necessarily unique to Islamic finance. Masoom mentioned, you know, very clearly that this could be applied to Christianity and other faiths as well. But we need to develop that reference point. And if we can, and we have that level of accountability, that can lead to more sustainable and inclusive societies.
And that's a very good point, because I think the way that the Quran and the Sunnahs have influenced this is you've got a codification in place that creates a moral standard. And the benefits around that is that you can understand where things are coming from to kind of create forward now to something that is more value-based around that initiative. I was going to ask, actually, and maybe Safina, you might have to pick up with this, in terms of how can that translate to something that helps financial inclusion, that, you know, as a Christian, as a Muslim, as a Jew, or even somebody who doesn't really have a religion they believe they follow, but has faith, whether it be faith in humanity or maybe wanting to have faith in humanity, what is it that you think we could do to make that change? What could be the thing that can make social inclusion kind of grow? And how could the finance industry be the influencer around that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think, one doesn't have to be particularly religious. I think, you know, it's that those kind acts that we go about, in fact, in our everyday lives. But Islamic finance, I think, is just bringing a different perspective because it's providing that transparency, as Shakib talks about, and also the traceability, and I think provides that trust, which I think is missing at the moment. So even in terms of charitable giving, there's not enough of it taking place because many people are a little bit nervous about sometimes where their donations are going. So this is also providing that transparency and traceability that people are looking for.
And that's really important because, you know, from the perspective of what you're looking at, this is no longer about then just the religion, the faith perspective, but you want to be able to believe in what you're doing, and that's absolutely vital. Masoom, do you want to add to that at all in terms of kind of thinking about that? Obviously, your faith is strong and you have some really interesting views in terms of where you come from.
My faith is strong. Okay, I'm feeling like to join the club back there, honestly, so I'm not really sure about that. Okay, when it comes to religion, I did another research on Christianity and Islam as well. So there's a boom and boost, rich versus poor. We have the welfare cuts and also the disguise for politics. Okay, so what I tend to collect from this data is there is an interesting theory or campaign on the boom versus the boost, and Islam really discourages the rich from taking advantages of the poor and separating the gaps. That's why we have things like zakat, we have sadaqah, that's just normal charity. You know, zakat is a must for you. You have to give zakat, and we are not doing it. You know, we are far away from doing those things. The tiny people, like, for example, now we have this National Zakat Fund, and the CEO is really struggling. He's your close friend, Iqbal. He's running a marathon with so much little cash to distribute. And there is a lot of people that are struggling as well. We'll go back to the economy now. So how religion comes into this is the transparency again, the accountability, you know, sharing, risk sharing, profit and risk sharing. And how can I add another thing so that I can make this a bit appealing to everyone? Okay. Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, they all promote the social welfare called Musama Amalat in Islam. I'm not really good in pronouncing the word, but I think that's how to pronounce it, right? Yeah. So it's the welfare for the general people, sort of like a benefit. If somebody is not strong, you give him a loan, don't take advantage, let him pay you back whenever he can pay you back. Okay, if you're dealing in a contract, write it down so that somebody doesn't take advantage. You have to have two people sitting down to have witnesses. If you're taking people's money, like Ansar, we're taking people's money, we have to disclose certain information to the Financial Conduct Authority. if we don't do it, then we are breaking the laws of God or Allah, as they put it. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Masoom. Okay, you've been listening to us for 40 minutes now. I'm sure your legs are starting to probably give way a little bit. So I want this opportunity now to ask if there are any questions out there for the panel. Oh, gosh, there's a one hand up quickly. I don't know whether this lead is... You may have to come forward a bit.
I'm a Christian priest and an economist, and I do bank with an Islamic bank because I think it's the best match to for ethical investing for Christian.
Are you allowed to name that bank?
It used to be called the First Islamic Bank, but they changed it to something I can never remember. Something like that, Al Rayyan. I get a lot of marketing about Zakat. It always focuses on giving from Muslims to Muslims. I've never been clear whether that's marketing or whether that's a religious duty. So the first question was to Safina, was it Muslims who were in receipt of the money in Kenya? And the other question, while I've got the mic, is $500 billion is a transformative amount of money, and the world hasn't so far been transformed. So what's it being spent on now?
Just to clarify, you know, that the giving, our view is, irrespective of whether you're Muslim or not Muslim, everyone is to benefit. So the example I gave from Kenya was, in fact, it was non-Muslim communities that benefited, mostly Christian, exactly. So that inclusive participation, absolutely. And I think, you know, there are many different schools of thought, but we absolutely, at the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, given you know, our values and principles on neutrality, etc., very much supporting anyone from any faith.
Just to add to that as well, I read about this Kenya story some time ago, and for me it was incredible that not only was it the funds were they distributed towards a majority Christian population, also where the funds came from, Malaysia, state in Malaysia. Of course, massively majority Muslim population. They gave, and correct me if I'm wrong on the numbers, around $1 million towards this initiative to produce agriculture-based products for the community, which can then sell them on. And the profit they made from this was $20 million. So they actually made a huge return on this $1 million contribution. And they then said... The Red Cross, I believe, said to them that you can now get 500,000 back for your work and effort. And they said that 500,000, we'd rather you give that to another village and they can benefit. So this is the type of sustainability which is, you know, built on, you know, this. All of these principles are shared principles, and it's built on them. Just to touch on the second question that you asked in terms of, $500 billion. That of course is a lot, and that's an annual number. So every year, and that's also a conservative number. Some estimates have put it over $1 trillion in terms of contributions. But there's two challenges in terms of why it could be more effective and it's not having the impact that we also desire. One is the collection challenge. It's not being centralized or collected in an efficient, transparent way. And the second is distribution. The funds are being distributed, of course, but there's no sharing of insights, knowledge in terms of how could they be effectively utilized, and we can benefit from those insights for future projects. And this is, of course, where Red Cross and other organizations are doing some incredible work in terms of using things like blockchain and other technologies to really make distribution a lot more efficient as well. So we're just getting started, but the scope and the potential, I've never been more optimistic.
Yeah, and I can add something as well. The way Zakat should work is if you live in England, you earn in England, you should give your Zakat in England. So, for example, we're here in Katrin, and I know the Muslim population maybe is just 1%, and then you take Zakat out, and then all the Muslims get benefits, or maybe they're even strong. They don't need Zakat. So, and then you have to distribute that wealth out. if, I mean, this young lady comes, she's pregnant. Sorry, I know you're not pregnant. She comes in and she needs help. You have to give that zakat. It's an obligation. So it's not only Christians. It's the people of the community. It's the wealth of that community you're extracting or taking that you have to give out. You're not using it for exploitation or anything. So that's the way zakat should work. But we just have extremists that turn it into negativity. You know, that's why I always say turn the negativity into positivity. So they're not selling. That's just marketing. Yeah.
And to link your two questions there, one of the issues that zakat has had is that because there are so many different fatwas and Sharia kind of complications around this, it's not a regulated giving, and the way often it works is that there are different views, and there are people out there that do take a view that this should only be for, you know, from Muslims given to the Muslim community to give them the opportunity to have access to that. The purest thought is around that it's for the needy, it's for the traveler, it's for a number of people that, you know, that have that need irrespective of their religion, and that's where the basis comes from. So there is some actually really real open challenges going on around this. And the figures, I think that's the thing, it's sitting as cash, it's doing nothing, because there is no system in place. So in Malaysia alone, we've just started looking at a project, working with an organisation whereby they can see how the different collection points around Malaysia could actually say, well, if you've got more in one area than the other and that needs more, how can they translate that across? And then how could they also collectively work to look at the kind of thing that the British Red Cross are doing? Because they can see that, you know, it's just a matter of scaling it and working with it, so it is possible. Right, next question. So, you're never going to get this, sir. Right.
Sorry, it's just because it kind of follows on from that. Can you just describe what the environment is that zakat is given through? Because, like, if you think about it in a Christian term, lots of people will give through their church and the church will distribute funds out, or there's lots of third sector organisations, so there's Christian Aid, and there's also sort of very small micro thing organisations that work at a local basis. Can you just describe how that zakat works?
Well, it's kind of ditto in a way. I mean, it comes down to you to some extent to understand where you want to do it. And I'll give you one example to help with this. So one of our clients is a court of protection case. So we work with the court deputy, who is an English lawyer, Christian, who's based in London, and the family, so it's for a little boy, very large sum of money. They decided that sum of money, even though it's to last him for the rest of his life, a portion of that has to go to zakat each year, otherwise they feel that he's not meeting his obligations. And he understands what zakat is, so it's deemed in terms of the Sharia advisors that it should be done. The family decided that they have generations of families back in Pakistan, and they wanted to give that zakat directly to kind of friends and relatives who needed it in Pakistan. And the court deputy went, well, hang on, I have to sign the check. So he flew to Pakistan, spent a week there visiting and verifying it so that he could go back to the courts and say, I'm going to give a very large check, way above I'm allowed to normally do, to this for zakat. This is how it works. And they deemed that fine. But there is actually, it's a problem. There's no central kind of body that kind of regulates that and picks up with that. I'll let this gentleman ask you his question, then maybe if you want to add to that after that.
There's been a mixture of mentions of giving and of finance, of lending. Could people talk about how the two combine, particularly thinking of financing people who can't pay back, for example, because of disabilities? And I'm beginning to think universal basic income, and maybe whether the state gets involved as well.
In Islamic finance, we have Qard Hasan. Qard Hasan is interest-free loan. And apart from that, we have the Sadaqah, which is the normal charity. We have Zakah, which is the obligation. Interest-free loan, of course, you give money, people pay you back without interest. Sadaqah should be designed for what you mentioned. Where is it? I can't even... Oh, yeah. So it should be designed to support people that have disabilities or their handicap, they cannot walk. And I mean, during the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him as well, as you know, there was this millionaire, he was one of the companions. He was called Usman. Usman was really wealthy, just like Umar. And what he did is he created this sukuk, what's called sukuk, bonds, and the Qard Hasan. But what he did is, he did Arid Hassan for specific reason. For those that cannot pay it, then you are forgiven. For those that can pay it back, you must give it back so that the trust keeps on building up. So, I mean, these days, I mean, a lot of institutions, they tend to push people. But the whole thing why we create these things is to empower ourselves. You know, we shouldn't even take it back in some cases. But if you can pay it back, why not bring it back so that we increase and build up more networks and help other people grow? So there is a lot of tools and facilities that do support people that are in need, honestly. Thank you very much.
Did you guys want to add to anything?
Yeah, I was talking to Masoom before we came here, and I found it incredible in terms of some of the work that his organization, Ansar, is doing. I mean, just so we're all on the same page in terms of the work that they're doing, if you have got a loan which you're struggling to pay back and you're paying interest on it, you can go to an organization which will say, we will pay that loan for you, and you clear your interest and you just pay non-interest payment, just the principal amount to us. For me, that's just incredible. And that's just to cut down your debt burden. And we were talking earlier on about in terms of risk transfer, risk sharing. This is the traditional banking model is all about transferring the risks onto the individuals. Whether you're rich, poor, it doesn't matter. You have to pay irrespective. Whereas what we're talking about, the Islamic or the partnership-based model is about is about sharing the risk, not just transferring it. So there's a lot of products. We talked about Zakat quite a bit, but that's just scratching the surface. There's also something called Waqf, which is a charitable endowment. And just in Malaysia alone, that's in the billions of dollars. So again, it's just how we, and Stuart touched on this point as well, the challenge we're not facing is we're not facing a resources challenge. We do have resources. It's how we centralize and bring that together and make the most out of it.
And just to explain, the Waqf was set up predominantly to kind of help with payment for graves and supporting kind of graveyards. And today, that's still going on. You know, there's billions of dollars sitting in these trust funds, and they're not taking them out. And that's, again, people like the British, well, like the International Federation, Red Cross, and other organizing charities saying, well, hang on, all this money's here, and you know, you've got enough of the graveyards. What about doing something good with the living? Let's do something about humanity. And of course, the actual way the trusts are written is that actually that is their main focus anyway. So that now in Malaysia, for social housing, for example, and they're kind of creating it, again, comes back to the cooperative type style in terms of that how that kind of works. And it's for the benefit purely for that welfare side. So it's important. We've probably got time for one more question.
Hi, I'm not sure if it's a question, but it's an observation, really. I'm a Christian, and I would be deeply troubled if I was told I had to give a certain amount of money. So there's a big argument in Christianity about whether you tithe or whether you don't. I happen to do an awful lot more than 10% with not very much. But for my money, it's a relationship that we have with God and with our Lord Jesus Christ, and our response is a financial one, as it is how we feed our friends, how we meet with our friends. It's a whole life response of which finance is a part, and I would be deeply troubled if I was told that I had to give a certain amount to a pot. And I think there is a lot of money around, from Christians or anyone else, that is being held and looked after very carefully, maybe Christian Aid, for example. And I wouldn't ever want to be in a place where transforming something was because I was told I had to give a certain amount of money. I do it as a response to God's love for me and my love for him.
And I'll respond quickly. I totally agree with you because it's the push or pull type scenario. I mean, I think certainly our focus here is certainly not about making Zakat the norm for everybody. And exactly, it's not pull. From our perspective, what we're working is around about social impact. So it's about going to people saying, and social impact's not about even creating a financial instrument for financial return. It's about measurement of the impact of the money you give, whether it be in a charitable way or actually as an investment way. And that's the whole point. It's about caring what your money does. And I think from my perspective, in terms of the way I view my Lord Jesus Christ as well, I'm totally on the same page as you because it's about how I feel my money relates to my passion and my way of living. Yeah. Absolutely. Does anybody want to add to that? I mean, it's a...
It depends on how you look at it. Out of the 100%, you're asked to give 2.5%. And it was the verse that was revealed on that was because there were millennials at that time as well. And there were people that were struggling. So the verse came down and it says, I know the way, I mean, you have... I mean, for us, it's difficult to subscribe to Islam as well. But we chose it because some parts of it, it's fair. Some, it's very difficult to adapt. And that's why you have sadaqah. Sadaqah, as you said, you can give whatever you want, depending on the trust and how you feel. But that 2.5%, it's not like a must for you. Look, you have to have certain income before you can give zakat. Then you don't give zakat. Then you don't. Yeah, it's not a must. Yeah. Yeah, and it's okay. It's fine. It's fine. Then you don't have to. Yeah, yeah. It's so simple and easy. Yeah. It's not like my income is not up to a zakat. I've never given zakat. Yeah. But I pray I give. So, yeah. So, do you want to add something as well? Okay. All right.
No, I mean, I guess just to agree, really, that you give as much as you can give. I think that is just the indicative, but it's not... You know, I don't think it would be forced upon, absolutely not. And as you say, it's about using your intellect and making a judgment call.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're just about drawing to a close. Is there any one final pushing question, quick one? Anybody at all? Oh, there's a gentleman. They're always at the back. There's two, actually. Look at that. Well, if they're very short questions, am I allowed two more questions? Is that okay, yeah? Okay, can you come forward, sir? I know who you are as well. It better not be a difficult question, Jonathan. Let this gentleman go first here, and then Jonathan, you can finish off.
Quick comment, really, rather than a question. Most people here will know the Lord's Prayer. There's a line in it about forgive us our sins as we forgive those that sin against us. In the Church of Scotland translation, I think I've got the right denomination, it's forgive us our debts as we forgive others that owe us. Which is kind of interesting because it puts a whole different interpretation, like an economic interpretation. Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah, very interesting. Thank you very much. Okay, for final question here.
Thank you. My question was really about the role of the state. And I wondered whether Islam puts an accountability on the state to be clear about what it's doing with its money, because I'm thinking of... when I was working with the UAE a few years ago, and he said it's quite difficult to find out what people are actually giving they're supposed to give and coordinate it with what we're doing, because they like to keep quiet about it. And looking at major investment flows in climate change, dictated by fossil fuel investors, we think of ExxonMobil, you know, and Shell, but actually the biggest funds are sovereign wealth funds, aren't they? In Norway, in Russia, quasi-state funds, and in Saudi Arabia. So what does Islam have to say about... the accountability of the government and how are we holding them to account?
Well, I didn't quite sure.
I told you it'd be an easy question.
Yeah, we don't kind of obviously stand here for the whole of Islam as a panel. I'd like not to put, you know, I mean, because Islam is obviously everybody's religion in terms of those who follow it, but I'm assuming you may have a...
Now, UAE, it's a cultural-based Gulf. You lived in Dubai, lived in Doha, and we know, so there's a Quranic version... verses 2, 282, verse 2, 283, 21, and 47, An-Nabiyya, Surah Al-Baqarah, and you have Surah Al-Imran. It really stresses out the need for transparency, accountability, again, governance. So I don't know what is happening in the UAE. I'm not a politician, and I don't want to know. But you have to disclose all information to the community, to your clients, to your family. So that is just common sense. I mean, it's not rocket science, is it? So, I mean, if Islam is not doing that, I'm not going to subscribe to it. Thank you very much. Does that answer your question? Okay, all right then.
It's a very good question. Just very quickly, briefly, Islam is quite unique in one particular sense, which is that you have your revelation, your scriptures, like all major religions, but then you have application of those as well in the form of a state. So the prophet, the messenger, when he revealed the message, he was also in a position to form a state and action on it. So there's a lot of examples in terms of the transparency and accountability and these things that we talk about, and how the funds, when they've been used or collected, how they've been utilized and distributed. So we do have a lot of examples, and there is a much more need for that clarity. And I think the work that we're trying to do on the ground touches on a lot of these points in terms of using technology that can allow us to access that in a more transparent way, how funds are being utilized. And that allows us to, whatever funds we do have, use them in a way that's much more effective on the ground.
Do you want to say a final comment at all? Well, look, thank you so much. Our hour is up. And thank you for sitting through us. I hope you found it useful and interesting and maybe a little bit challenging as well, which is the whole point behind these discussions. I got just one or two little quick points. We do obviously have two more panels kind of following this theme, picking up around impact investing tomorrow and on Monday looking at the kind of future of money and how that works. And I've got a quote here actually to finish with, and it goes, "It is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system. For if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." And that was Henry Ford. So that kind of gives you an idea. And the very final point, actually, I want to thank, I've got two of my children who have come and supported us to sit here for an hour here. And also one at the back and a friend. And I did say, we're not here to tell jokes. However, I have got a joke. So knock, knock. Cannelloni. Can you loan me some money, please? So can I put your hands together and thank you for my panel and thank you for your attention.